The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 5th of October, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Andrew Knott, Chief Executive Officer of Savannah Petroleum. SAVP is the ticker, and Andrew talks about their fifth consecutive successful oil discovery in Niger. Also on the podcast, Paul Haywood, Director of Block Energy, BLOE is ticker there, and Paul discusses the MOU they've signed with one of the largest private gas suppliers in Georgia for a proposed offtake agreement for their gas produced at their West Rastavi permit. Also on the podcast, Rob Proctor, Chief Executive Officer of Audioboom, BOOM, discusses their recent trading update. Plus, I have a list of the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. You can see the top 10 at voxmarkets.co.uk, and also the top five most liked RNSs too.
Want to know which companies are about to list on the London Stock Exchange? To see an up-to-date list of all the new and upcoming London IPOs, please visit voxmarkets.co.uk/IPO-watch.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Knott, CEO of Savannah Petroleum. SAVP is the ticker there. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I should say congratulations, and we'll get into why in a bit, but really good bit of news. Before we do, Andrew, get in the news, for people brand new to the podcast or not familiar with your company, can you just summarise what Savannah Petroleum is all about, please?
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so Savannah Petroleum is an AIM-listed gas company. We've been around for 4 years. We have two principal business units, one in Niger, where we have 50% of the main petroleum basin under licence, and one in Nigeria. We're in the process of acquiring a business that supplies 10% of the country's power supply. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, we think those assets are large, with a lot of growth potential, which we're in the process of working our way through. And this morning's announcement is part of that process.
Excellent stuff. Yes. Well, it's the fifth consecutive oil discovery, the Zumu oil discovery in Niger. That's you must be very happy with this, Andrew.
Yeah. Look, I mean, as a company, we're very, very happy, and I think what is particularly encouraging is that what's happened in our drilling campaign, we've now, from the beginning of this year, we've now drilled four consecutive discoveries, is that the thesis that we said when we did the IPO, the thesis that we said when we've raised the money around the prospectivity of the acreage is prone to come in. The acreage is a very large position. We've got 120 undrilled structures, for example. It's over 14,000 square kilometres. It's very low cost to operate. The historic basin average finding cost is about $1 a barrel, and it's very technically low risk. Like, we've now drilled five consecutive oil discoveries. The other major operator in the basin, who's drilled a lot more wells than us, they've had over 75% of their wells prove successful and have oil discoveries. And what we've also managed to show is that it's relatively straightforward to monetize those oil discoveries. We've now made a lot of advances in terms of the creation of an early production scheme, which will enable us to start producing significant volumes next year. The progress in the Niger business is very good, and it will continue. We will deliver first oil, we'll do the well test, and then early next year we'll start drilling again, and we have a host more prospects with a similar risk profile to go after to those that we've already to those that we've drilled this year.
Yeah. And so if people are listening now, like you say there, just to summarise, when do you hope to bring these discoveries into production? When's the first production coming off, hopefully?
Okay, so what we're going to do the well test on AMT-1, which is one of the discoveries that we made. Mm-hmm. And then following that, we expect to start trucking the oil produced from that well in Q1 next year. And then that will ramp up over the course of the year, hopefully to 5,000 barrels a day as we lay a pipeline for that. And we announced a deal with the Ministry of Energy and Petroleum of Niger, which is expected to give us access to the refinery, and which will give us the market to sell it. And then over the medium term, what you will see is there's been tremendous progress in terms of the other major operator in the basin. has significantly advanced their plans this year to build a large pipeline which will enable export volumes to be taken to Nigeria and Benin, which is expected to be in place by 2021.
Excellent stuff. There's a question here, just got in from a private investor. I'm not sure if it's accurate. I'll put it to you anyway. It says the Zuma well was partly drilled to see if it was connected or part of the great discovery there. Is it one large field? Do you know that yet?
Okay, so the Zuma well was primarily drilled because it's a good, robust, standalone exploration prospect.
Yeah.
There is an upside case, which... whereby you could have everything connected, but that will require a well test to prove definitively one way or the other. So at this stage, we continue to say that's not the base case, but it remains a possibility.
Okay, all right, good stuff. But
it should be quite exciting if it happened, but it's exciting enough to make a discovery.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bonus, but like you say, but it's on its own, economically viable, and it is an exciting discovery on its own. So, personally, Andrew, when you first started off, did you sort of know? Of course, there was obviously a high chance of success here, but five consecutive wells. That's quite rare, isn't it?
I think it's very rare, and if you look on our investor presentation. There are several slides which explain why the success rate is what it is. Essentially, it boils down to, it doesn't matter where you are anywhere in the world, for an oil and gas field to exist, four things must have happened. The first is oil's got to have been sourced or made. The second is once the oil's been made, it will move and it will migrate, just the nature of how hydrocarbons work. And then you need it to migrate for you to have an oil field. It needs to migrate into like a hard, spongy rock, so a rock with holes in it which can hold the oil in place. And then you need a seal or sort of something to trap the oil to stop it going any further. In our basin, every single well that's been drilled has encountered hydrocarbons. Every single well that's been drilled has encountered reservoir quality rock. So what that means is your first three risks, your sourcing, migration, and the reservoir risk are really very, very small. And then when a well typically doesn't work, it doesn't work because the trapping mechanism is faulty. And the way you mitigate that in the basin is the wells that we're drilling, you typically have five reservoirs to target, so you have five shots to try and find a reservoir that's trapped. And we also have the benefit of very good seismic data, which gives you a very good image of how that trapping geometry could work. So the main reason why the success rate is so high is very well understood, because you've got so much reservoir rock and there's been so much oil being generated in the basin. And that's really what constrains the risk profile. But in answer to your original question, did we expect every well to have oil trapped? I think we were more anticipating a success rate is more akin to that of the basin operator, which has three and four wells having worked. But we always expected and always had the view that this was a very, very unique, low-risk, low-cost, high-value opportunity.
Yeah.
We always had that view.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so just one final thing to put in people's heads. So what's next here, and what's your next sort of big milestone ready, Andrew?
Okay, so there's an awful lot of stuff coming up. So this month, we expect there to be news on Nigeria, so around what's called the implementation agreement, which is the key document that should enable the completion of the Seven Energy transaction. The following month, we will be submitting the EPS to the Ministry of Petroleum, so there'll be further news on the early production system and how those cash flows are going to work. In December, we'll have the early well test, and then beginning early next year, we'll start drilling again. I don't want to give specific times on this, but I think you can expect news on new customer ads in Nigeria. I think you can expect news on additional resource ads in Nigeria. But the timing of that is uncertain. It depends when we do the deals. But there's an awful lot going on in the business just now, but we're very, very focused on just developing the two assets that we have. So this big world-scale asset that we have in Niger and the very attractive high-growth business we have in Nigeria.
Marvellous stuff. Well, one final thing, Andrew, as you know, people listening to this, I like the sound of this fifth consecutive discovery you've made, but and not yet following the story, Give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, so I think the first reason is just, I think we're a high quality company. We've got two very good asset bases. We have a board and management team that have a very strong track record of delivering value for stakeholders across a very long period of time. So I believe we have quality assets and a very strong management team. Mm-hmm. And then in relation to the assets specifically, in terms of the Niger business, we have a business where your typical finding cost is around $1 a barrel. The NPV is, say, around $6 a barrel. And we have 120 plus structures we've identified that we could high grade for drilling, and I expect to identify more structures over time. So I think we've got a repeatable, sustainable business in Niger, which is capable of delivering at relatively low cost a whole lot of high value barrels. So I think that is the Niger business. In terms of the Nigerian business, the Nigerian business has a very unique asset in terms of it's the only gas distribution network in the part of the country in which it operates. There's very strong pricing dynamics, so I expect to be able to add a lot of customers at a higher margin to that which we're currently producing. And there's a lot of resource available, which I would hope we can do commercial deals around to get access to. So I think both those businesses have a lot of growth, and I think that puts the business in a really good position over the course of the coming months and years.
Marvellous stuff. Andrew, good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hayward, Director of Bloch Energy. BLOE is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Justin. Good to be in touch again.
Yeah, especially with some good news. And, you know, so you've signed an MOU, and we'll get into the details of that in a bit. Before we do, Paul, you're relatively new to the exchange, yes. To listing, so let's have a summary. What is Bloch Energy all about, please?
Bloch Energy is an E&P company listed on AIM under the ticker, as you just mentioned, BLOE. We listed in June this year, having raised £5 million. We're fully funded, just about to move into our imminent work programme.
Excellent stuff. And just go over, you know, what kind of interest, what prospects you have there, what assets you have in Georgia.
Yeah, sure. Well, we're 100% in the Norio oil field, which to date has produced just over 2.2 million barrels of oil. That's currently producing oil for us to date. We're a 90% working interest in the Satskanesi oil field, which has produced just over 500,000 barrels of oil. And we're currently farming into the West Rastavi oil and gas field, which sits contiguous to the largest discovery in Georgia, which is at its peak, produced 70,000 barrels of oil a day, and is currently owned 100% by Schlumberger, who are drilling their first well.
So you signed a memorandum of understanding for a gas offtake from your West Rastavi license, and that's with quite a big player out there, isn't it?
It is indeed, Justin. This is all in line with the company's strategy to exploit its gas potential throughout its West Rastavi license that currently has a contingent gas resource of over 600 BCF. That is absolutely a very firm focus of the company going forward. And signing this MOU brings us one step closer to finalising our marketing contracts as and when we move into development of that asset.
Yeah, so it's with... Is it Bago or Bago? Or how do you say them?
If you speak to a Georgian, it's pronounced Bargo. But
Bargo.
Obviously
I got it wrong on both counts.
There is no R, so we would pronounce it Bago.
Yeah.
But they are the largest Georgian-owned gas purchaser in-country. Interestingly enough, since Schlumberger entered back in 2017, there's been a lot of independent traders setting up in-country, hunting oil and gas sales contracts from local contractors. But Bargo have been in the market for the past 20 years. They've got significant capacity and they're extremely nimble and creative with their contracts. As you may have seen from the announcement, they've got a very strong interest in actually assisting the company with funding its requirements with regards to setting up infrastructure to enable us to market our gas as and when we move through that plan. So they're very well-known players in the market. fantastic capacity, very strong balance sheet, and significant expertise within the company also. So no, it's a very, very good alliance for us to be forming, and we look forward to advancing that relationship.
Yeah, so for people not au fait with gas terms or oil terms, so you're saying they will acquire a total amount of gas produced from the West Derby subject to a minimum of 1,000 cubic metres of gas per day. How does that translate into sort of money or oil or whatever, or something we can deal with?
In BOE terms, which is a term the market understands, that's around 172 barrels of oil equivalent a day, which is, as I explained earlier, is at the bottom end of our forecast, that's for sure. But most importantly, they've got capacity to acquire anything up to around 175,000 BOEs a day. So, wow. deep demand from Bargo.
So pretty much as much as you can produce, they'll take, will they?
As much as we can produce, and many more, given current domestic production. But it just goes to show that there's there is massive appetite in Georgia for gas right now for many different reasons. And I think if you go back over some of the podcasts, we've discussed that at length.
Yeah. And so at the moment, you hold 25% working interest in that license, but it's increasing to 75%. When will that be happening?
Very good question. So two stages left for us to complete our 75% working. Initial stage is preparing wells for two sidetracks. We're expecting to move that work along, if not complete it, before Christmas this year. We would then expect to be drilling our first sidetrack before Christmas this year. Our second sidetrack will be completed shortly after, I'll say, tail end of January, beginning of February of next year. So as of Q1 next year, we'd expect to be 75% working interest in the license and moving forward with speed on developing the gas potential.
Yeah. One final question on that. I mean, they said they're considering as well financing wholly or part required gas infrastructure at West Derby. So that's another positive move, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. I mean, that would obviously mean that we would not need to go back to the equity markets to raise further money to take the gas into development, which is something, you know, we've got many options with regards to structured finance solutions and debt to fund the gas as and when we take that part of the plan forward. There is strong demand from the Georgian government to come in and provide debt solutions, but having Bargo put their hand up and say, actually, guys, not only do we want to buy all the gas you can produce and more, we're also willing to fund your infrastructure to ensure that you can move this thing along as quickly as possible. Just adds, you know, heaps of confidence around the program, and has really spurred management to kind of fast track its understanding and development of the gas potential. And currently, we've got our first gas test in well number 30 that's flowed significant amounts of gas in the past. A retest of that well pegged for Q1, Q2 next year. But as you may remember, there's a lot of activity going on around us at the moment, and success next door from Schlumberger's gas well would possibly lead us to moving that retest forward and expediting that plan. So there really is a lot going on, but the stars are aligning at the moment, Justin, but not everybody's paying attention, as you can see from our share price. So we think we're extremely well valued at the moment, and there's lots of reasons to keep an eye on what we're doing.
Yeah, and you say that your target is to get up to sort of 900 barrels of oil per day in 18 to 24 months, is that right?
Yes, indeed. We've been extremely conservative with that forecast. We'd expect to be not too far from that after our two sidetracks and earning of West Derby. But definitely within 18 to 24 months. Lots going on in the meantime. And the sooner we can get there, the better. Oil for us is, exploiting the oil potential is the low-hanging fruit for us currently at $80 oil. So at these levels, we need to be producing circa 75 to 80 barrels a day to be company break even. So the barrels of oil produced for us in Georgia are extremely profitable, get us into a very healthy cash flow position.
What is the margin there, Paul? What is the margin on that, do you think?
Netbacks at today's prices are circa $40 per barrel, if not slightly more. That's a conservative number, actually. So, we're in a very, very healthy place. It's exciting times, Justin.
marvellous stuff. Yeah, well, listen, if someone is, you know, listening to you talking about this and they think, oh, hang on, and they can see there's sort of around about 8 million market cap and they can see potential. Give them, in summary, three quick reasons, Paul, why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
As per our last announcement, or announcement before today's announcement, we've just finalised our rig contract. So lots of activity about to kick off in the field. So definitely a reason to follow us. We're funded throughout this programme. So we will be, again, lots of activity ongoing, at least over the next 4 to 5 months. And, you know, we're very cheap. And I think there's going to be a lot of action in the share price over the next coming months. And definitely one to keep an eye on.
Marvellous stuff, Paul. Thanks for that. And like I said, lots of news, so we'll be chatting again soon, no doubt. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin. Speak soon. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Rob Proctor, CEO of Audio Boom. That's B-O-O-M ticker. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Good afternoon, Justin. Hope you're well.
Yes, I'm good. Now, listen, I always like to do this, Rob, because there are new people joining all the time and we assume things and we shouldn't assume. But for people listening and may or may not have heard of you, what is Audio Boom about then? Explain to them.
So Audio Boom's a podcasting platform with all the technology that you need to create, upload, distribute and monetize podcasting. But in essence, what we do as a company is we create content and we sell advertising, all in the audio, digital audio space.
Excellent stuff. Now, a couple of people said to me, get Rob on the podcast, you released a trading update, and your revenue is looking good. You can take us through the figures. But the share price took a bit of a knock, down 30%. It was 40% at one point. And I think that was down to, huge, massive knock. And someone said, get him on there, get him to justify his job because of this big knock. I mean, revenue looking good, like I said, but it was the EBITDA where you say, current market expectations with a consequential material impact going to suffer there. So take us through the issues here, the good points and the bad points and what's happening here, Rob, if you could.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, we are honor bound to put a statement out. I think the revenue we're going to get to within market expectations, EBITDA, is going to be just outside the 10% of market expectations. So we're honor bound to put that out. Mm-hmm. I think as for the reasons behind the increase in the EBITDA loss, I'm not going to go back over, what happened with Triton. But I think everybody I spoke to, I think when I was on your show last time as well, we talked about it. The damage that was caused to our reputation and therefore the podcasters that we lost off our platform, therefore the inventory that we have to sell, was massively impacted. And, I've been saying that for the last 4 or 5 months.
So what happened? Why did they leave? Why did podcasters leave? Because you were going to merge with Triton, and so you had podcasters leaving because of that. Why?
No, for sure. So again, I want to talk about the positives more than the negatives that's caused us where we got to. Look, the cost of the failed Triton acquisition was huge. All of that money came out of our cash flow. We would use that cash flow in the normal events of our model to pay our podcasters upfront to minimum guarantees. We reclaim that upfront money across the life of our contract with them before we do the revenue share. So it's obviously a short-term hit on cash flow. During that extended period of the failed Triton acquisition, we got to the point, because the cash flow was going out on those costs, we couldn't re-sign podcasters we already had and were doing great with, because we couldn't pay their upfront payments. So they went to other places that would. Plenty of startups out there raising 10s and 20s. And a new startup in the US 4 weeks ago raised $40 million off plan. They don't have anything. But so those companies are in the market playing minimum guarantees. So we lost podcasters and inventory we already had. As well as that, you're obviously having to keep filling the top of that hopper, if you like, the conveyor belt of podcasters coming on. We had to drop out of the market in those negotiations to bring new podcasters onto our platform for that 4 or 5 month period as well. That clearly affected what we'd forecast for revenue, because we would have forecast those people coming on. A combination of those two things meant we had probably 40, 45% less inventory at the top end, the top podcasters, than we would have forecasted at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. That obviously has an impact on revenue throughout the entirety of the year, because you obviously don't have that inventory moving forward for 1 or 2 years, whatever life of the contract is. Given that hole, that cratering that had happened in our inventory levels, as I've said to everybody over the last 4 or 5 months, that damage was profound to do our revenue number this year, and therefore our revenue numbers next year. We had to get back into the market, and we had to get aggressive in signing those established podcasters with audience onto our platform. Look, we know we can monetize, we know what the sell-through rate is, we know what the CPMs are, we can predict revenues. That's great. So our forecasting to the end of this year and into 2019, super accurate. But in order to get that volume of podcasters back onto the platform, we've had to go in and compete with all of the other companies in the market, especially in the US here, and those new startups with, like, say, $10, $20, $30, $40 million off plan. So that's driving up the cost of the minimum guarantees and the upfront payments. Yes, you get it back before you revenue share, but you've got to put that cash out in order to sign those contracts. We've spent 4 months doing that. It's paid off. We are back out of that hole. You can see the revenue coming through. I think on the trading update, you know, our Q3 revenues is a record month for us, and again, or a record quarter for us, given where our inventory was. We would have had not a cat in hell's chance of doing that revenue number if we hadn't signed those podcasters back onto the platform. And we would have no chance of doing the kind of Q4 number that's shaping up already, which is going to get us almost to that market expectation number on revenues that was put out there months ago. Again, we physically couldn't get to that number without signing podcasters. I guess the other thing that shows that's absolutely the truth is when you look at our yield, so our yield on the trading update there would be our ECPM, our effective advertising rate. From the beginning of the year, we were at $14 per thousand adverts that we sold out there. That number's now climbed to over $20 per thousand, so our yield is higher, our sell-through rates are better, but our gross revenue number is all down to converting X number of thousands by $20 to get your revenue. The issue I've got now as a company, we go back 18 months ago, my problem was I had millions and millions of available ad impressions, but we were still waiting for advertisers to move into this space. The issue that I've got today is I've got more advertisers than I've got inventory that I can serve up. So again, if we hadn't aggressively gone in the market and spent that money to sign the podcasters, I wouldn't even be able to service those advertisers. You know, even through, you know, end of Q1, when we started losing podcasters, Q2 when it hemorrhaged, and Q3 when some other contracts finished as well, but we filled back in Q3, during that whole period, the requirement for us to stick to our model, do what we need to do, bring podcasters on in order to guarantee the future of this business and therefore our revenues moving forward through 19, right there was the pinch point for our company. And if we'd not spent the money and therefore driven up the EBITDA loss, then the business quite literally would have had no future moving forward. As it is, our revenue number this year is still going to put us, you know, in the top 3 podcasting companies on the planet. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're running a loss, but you know, compared to every other company out there, we're now getting towards profitability on a monthly basis because our revenue's driving so high. All of those other startups and those guys, they're going to burn through their 10, 20, 30, 40 million over the next 6 to 9 months. We've got a model that works now. We know how to work it. But without the inventory, we've got nowhere to go.
Yeah. And I suppose in a trading update, like you say, the Q1, Q2, I mean, trading updates, of course, are historical and it's looking forward now. So the hit has been taken, as you say. And do you think now you are in recovery mode or heading towards almost surpassing, you know, where you should have been?
We've been in recovery mode literally since the day I stamped my foot and I called time on the transaction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, without being melodramatic, if we'd not done or I'd done what I did, you know, back in June, we wouldn't even be having this conversation now, mm-hmm. Justin, to be honest with you. We caught it just in time. The team in the UK and in the US have done an amazing job of, you know, leveraging, you know, it took us 5 years to build a great reputation in the podcast industry. It took us 5 months through the Triton transaction to absolutely decimate that reputation. We've leveraged those 5 years and we've got podcasters back on. We can see the revenue growth is already there. We've been paying it, if you like, paying it forward to bring those podcasters on. So like I say, our forecasting is as accurate as it can be now. And when we're getting organic growth in podcasters coming back on the market now because we're servicing the advertisers. I mean, even through that three-quarter period there, and Q3 has been a great rebuilding process for us, the thing that gives me the most heart, and again, it's in the trading update, but the brand count, the number of brands that are working and advertising with us, even through Q1 and Q2 and into Q3, has grown by double digits, quarter on quarter on quarter. So the advertisers are there, our distribution is there, we just need more and more inventory now. I mean, it's, you know, we are in a high growth sector, highly competitive sector, but listens are growing beyond all proportion. More and more of the population is picking this thing up. Digital home assistants are driving usage. Spotify's adoption is driving usage. Google adding their native podcast player to Android phones is going to massively drive usage over the next 2 to 3 years. Nothing in our model is wrong. It's more refined all the time. We know where we're going. We know what our margins are. If we'd not spent what we'd spent in the last 4 months to fill our hole back up again, this business would not have a future. We're now back on a growth curve that's exactly the same as it was this time last year. It's just the overall gross revenue number, because of this, you know, this undue spend in the last 4 months fill a hole. Both of those lines have been knocked back. I mean, Triton on its own cost us $1.2 million in cost. The revenue cost to us, because we couldn't keep filling that pipeline on our model, is got to be somewhere closer to £5 million in gross revenue this year. So instead of doing, you know, 8.8-9 million, we should have been at 13.5-14 million this year. But those models and those forecasts are still the same. We know how it works. We know how this industry works. We know how to sign podcasters. We know how to make great podcasts that climb the charts all over the place. As a business, we know what we're doing. You know, hindsight's a great thing, but clearly going down the route of that acquisition with Triton was madness for this company.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned there you're heading towards profitability on a monthly basis, and that's looking good, isn't it? So I mean, when do you hope to be, you know, profitable? Sort of, you know, when is that? You're heading towards it, when is that?
Again, welcome to AIM and all of that and what I can and can't say and good stuff. But, I mean, if we keep growing the way we've been growing since we've started rebuilding this damage from, you know, the end of June into July, and we keep our growth rate, and, you know, we can see what our pre-bookings are now all the way through to the end of December. If we keep that growth rate going with the margins, then early into the new year on a monthly basis, we're going to start getting this company into profit. You know, we've done the forecast based on what we spent, what our sales are and what the margin are. You notice there's no, cash warning in that training update or anything like that, and you can bet your bottom dollar the Nomad's crawled all over the numbers and the forecasting and our pre-bookings and all of that when we put yesterday's trading update out. So would I sit here and tell you exactly when we're going to do that? And blah, blah, blah? No, of course I'm not, because I'll probably get into a million AIM regulation troubles. Anybody reading that trading update, they should be able to see the growth in revenue. And now that I've explained exactly why we've spent more money to fill that hole, but that's kind of one-off expenses to sign those podcasters. Our monthly headcount costs and, basic services costs and all of that, as was reported at the half year, all of those things are absolutely in line with where we said they would be. And the other reductions we announced at the RAGM, all of those reductions have been put in place, and those cost savings are working through the model now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, one other thing, you say, podcasting is very hot. I mean, and when you get a hot sector, it attracts a lot of inward sort of investment from, companies, like you said, new startups. Are you finding it hard competing against those startups?
Well, again, we'd already decided that, our model works best mm-hmm. when we can create our own content, more of our own content, and more co-productions, like our one with Formula One, and obviously Jonathan Ross has come on the platform, and Joe Wiley and various other people. When we do a co-production, we make 50%. When we do our own productions, we have cost of production, and that varies between shows, but the margin on that is a lot higher than 50%. When we bring the third parties on, our margin's only 25 to 30%. And that's the area we'd be competing with those startups. Mm-hmm. So in this period, to give us inventory, therefore I listened and listeners, we've gone out and we've brought more third-party content onto our platform to fill that hole, to give us the revenue that we said we would be doing through this year. My job through 2019 is to take the sales mix from 75% or so third party, 15% or so owned and operated, and the rest co-production. By the end of 2019, my goal, my hope, is that we've got 50% of revenue coming from third party podcasters we bring on, and 50% coming from co-productions and owned and operated. If we do that, we move our gross margin to a better place, around 40%. But the big thing is it takes us out of that, superheated, market where we're competing against all of that startup money for established podcasts with established audience. We're growing our own audiences on our own content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Rob, anyway, thanks for coming on and just explaining that, because I know a lot of shareholders be glad of that, and not the drop, the explanation I'm talking about.
No.
But, one final thing, Rob, for people listening who may want to take advantage of this drop, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, I mean, the first one is the market cap and the share price. I mean, yes, we're a UK company. Yes, we're listed. And we're not playing in that US market. But I would urge anybody out there to go and look at the market caps that all of these startups and companies that have been around a year or two, the money they're raising and at the valuations they're raising them at. I mean, I think our current market cap is probably about 20 million at the moment, or whatever, it might even be less than that.
Yeah.
As I speak to you, given what we do, where we are, the revenues we generate, and that revenue growth that we're showing, I got to say that the share price right now is wholly unreflective of what this business is and where it's going. and more importantly, where the overall podcast market is going. I think the second one, as I just alluded to, you know, the company in terms of revenue and revenue growth, double-digit growth on all of our major KPIs. You know, we know how this industry works and we know how the model works. We've had 5 or 6 years of proving that. The last 6 months, up until 2 months ago, were an aberration on what that growth trajectory is and what this market trajectory is. So again, you know, if you want to invest in a hot sector in a company that knows what it's doing and now has the inventory and the sales teams to match that, then I think, you know, we're in the right place. And I think the third one really is the new chairman that we have on board, you know, Mike Tobin. You know, he's only been with us 6-8 weeks. You saw him buy stock in the market today. He didn't come on board because he thought we were doing the wrong thing or that this industry didn't have massive opportunity and this company isn't brilliantly well placed within that exploding industry to do something pretty major. You know, Mike's a busy guy. He helped and has run and still running some massive, busy companies. He ain't going to get involved in this company and spend his own money on our own stock unless he thought there was some huge upside in it for him.
Marvellous. Rob, good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
All right, Justin, thank you so much for your time, mate.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Gfinity PLC, that's G-F-I-N. At four, Armadale Capital, ACP. At three, Alpha Growth, ALGW. At two, Cradle Arc, that's CRA. And number one, most followed company, is Block Energy. That's, of course, Paul is on the podcast today. BLOE is ticker. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Tech Capital, that's Science Advisor Appointment. At four, Infrastrata, Director Shareholding, that's the CEO, buying more stock. At three, Flying Brands, result of EGM and change of name. At two, Savannah Petroleum, Zomo Oil Discovery. And number one, most liked RNS came from UK Oil and Gas, Extended Well Test and Regulatory Update. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.